And he's on it.
A.J. Foyt has won his fourth 500-mile race.
It's a drag race. Marco Andretti, Cornish, who's going to win? At the stripe, it's home.
Goodyear makes a move. Little Al wins by just a few tenths of a second.
You just don't know what Indy means.
More Front Wings Centennial Interview Series.
Welcome to another episode of More Front Wings Centennial Interview Series. Today we're speaking with two-time winner of the Indianapolis 500, Al Unser Jr. Al, thanks so much for joining us today.
You betcha. Thanks for having us on.
Al, you had 19 starts in Indianapolis and your two wins, of course, in 92 and 94. And you had a pole to go with that win in 1994. And you were third in laps completed with 3,173, putting you behind only your father and A.J. Foyt.
Yeah, that's amazing. It was just, that one record was, the laps completed was just a very fortunate thing. And you know, it was, I had a great teams. I had great crews that gave me great cars to do that. So.
Absolutely. And your excellent career at Indianapolis speaks to that for sure. Before we start into your career for yourself at Indianapolis, though, let's talk a little bit about your earlier life in Indianapolis, because yours starts a bit earlier than most drivers. Can you talk about the experience of watching your father and your uncle race at IMS when you were a child?
It's truly what made me fall in love with the Indy 500 is when I was 8 years old in Albuquerque. The Indy 500 was broadcast on the big screen TVs on closed circuit TV, which you go to an auditorium and you see it, and it was the Johnny Lightning car in 1970 that was just so big on the screen and beautiful and you know, my dad was driving it, and it was truly what made me fall in love with Indy, and truly from that point on, it was a dream of mine to come to Indy and race.
Well, Al, you finally got to the track in 1983, or you finally made the race in 1983. Can you walk us through a little bit of how that month went for you, what you remember coming to the track as a rookie, and of course, you were kind of involved in a little bit of controversy there at the end, the last 15 laps or so. Can you walk us through some of how the race went for you that year?
Sure. Every day was a new day for me, and so I didn't know what to expect. Like I said earlier, I had a great crew. I had a great team. I was driving for Rick Gallus out of Albuquerque, New Mexico, and we had the only Eagle, Dan Gurney built Eagle in the race that year. And so we ended up qualifying fifth, which was really, really good. And I remember the first weekend of qualifying got rained out, and so we had to go to the second weekend, and I didn't think it was that big of a deal. You know, my dad was going, oh, you know, now it's a shame that we couldn't get qualified, so we couldn't prepare for the race. And I was going, nah, that's no big deal, you know, that's okay. And so we went and we qualified on that second weekend and got in the show and all that, you know, and it worked out really good. And then during the race, we had a good car. You know, if I would have had a little bit more experience, or quite a bit more experience actually, we would have been in contention for winning that race, because the car was fast enough. And it showed at the end, when I got between my dad and Tom Sneva, and of course I was wanting my father to win the race and all that kind of stuff, and so we were trying to make it as hard as possible for Tom Sneva to get by, and so at the end of the race there was a bit of issue on whether I was blocking or not, and quite simply, I wanted my dad to win the race, yeah, you know, but you know, realistically, I was not blocking Tom, and if I was blocking Tom, my dad would have won the race. Put it that way.
Well, your career in Indianapolis continued on, and so let's fast forward to 1989. You were still gunning for your first win at that point, obviously, when you were in that amazing late race duel with Emerson Fittipaldi that saw you tag wheels with him, and you end up in the wall and him go on to win the race. Can you talk a little bit about what that was like to go through when you were still looking for your first win and wondering if you'd ever get it done?
I was wondering if I would ever get it done. That's very true. 89 was truly, I felt, one of my best drives. It was one that Goodyear had brought a hard tire and a soft tire, and we were one of the only teams that got the soft tire to do a full load of fuel, a fuel stint. And so we had a very fast race car that day, and you know, I was implementing something that my father had taught me, which is the only lap you want to lead is the last one. And so you take care of your equipment, you put yourself in position to win the race at the end. And so we were doing that all day long. And honestly, there late in the race, Emerson had one more stop. I had already made my final stop. I was running second, and we were running around under green. I let Emerson get out about 15 seconds in front of me, and I was just cruising. I had the boost turned down low, and had a yellow not come out, you know, Emerson had to make a stop. We would have gone on to lead the race and just win it. You know, that's what position we were in. But unfortunately, a yellow came out. Emerson was able to pit and come back out, and he came back out right in front of me. When it went green again, the race was on. It was time to turn up the boost. It was time to go. And we actually had a faster car at the end of the race than Emerson did. And I think it truly surprised him, you know, because hands down, he was the one that led most of the day and all that kind of stuff. And there I was at the end coming up and trying to steal it away from him. We got into some traffic and unfortunately, you know, we both went into turn three, and there was only one guy going to come out of that corner. And it was Emerson and not me. And so he came around and I had time to reflect on the day, and, you know, I gave him thumbs up and congratulated him on his win.
So you truly never did have any hard feelings about it then? Did you really write it off as a racing incident? You must have talked to him about it at some point through the years.
It definitely was a racing incident. I've known Emerson prior to that, and Emerson he's a great human being, and you know, the last thing that he would want to do to anybody would be to crash him or to hurt him or anything like that. But when you're in the competition and you're at the Indy 500, and I said this after the race, winning is the only thing that matters, and that was what mattered to both of us when we went into turn three. I was disappointed. You know, I remember talking to the safety crew when I started to head out to the track, and he tried to stop me, and he goes, "Where are you going?" And I said, "Well, I'm going out there." And he goes, "Well, what, you want to flip him off or something?" And I went, "Yeah." and he said, "Okay, go right ahead." You know. And so once I got out there, of course we were under yellow, so it was a few seconds before Emerson came around, and it gave me time to reflect, you know, on the day, and I saw all the people, and they were expecting it, you know, they were expecting me to do that, and I just, you know, I just had a moment of clarity, and that moment of clarity was reflecting on the day, and Emerson was coming around to get the checkered flag. And so I congratulated him on his win because he did a great job, and he was going to win the Indy 500. So.
Well, that was one of the iconic images of that era at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, absolutely. So it added to the history of the event just as much possibly as any of your wins ever did.
Well, thank you. It was, it was a great day. Unfortunately, you know, when I got in the ambulance after Emerson had gone by, I definitely broke down into tears, no doubt about it.
Well, Al, if you hadn't come upon that lap traffic at the end, I think it was Ludwig Heimrath that you met just as you entered turn two at that time. If you hadn't caught him right then, could Emerson have caught you that race, do you think?
No. And I know that because we actually caught the traffic coming off at turn two, and it had wrecked my momentum. And so when I pulled out, Emerson had already had a run on me, and he was already on the inside of me. And so when I pulled out to pass the lap traffic, Emerson pulled up next to me, but then the second half of the straightaway, I started pulling away from him. And so we definitely had a faster car than he did that day, and I only showed it at the end. I didn't show it any other time, but you know, it ended up the way it ended, and you know, that's what happens at Indy. You know, you're meant to win it, and if it's your day, then it's your day, and that's all there is to it.
Well, I think if you talk about winning one that you're meant to win and maybe one that you hadn't dominated, that leads us perfectly right then into 1992. You had a quiet month that year, probably a little bit down on power with the older Chevrolet engine that year, especially compared to the Buicks and the new Fords that year. Talk again a little bit about 1992, kind of leading into the race, what it was like being kind of in the background, if you will, and then all of a sudden finding yourself, you know, at 10 laps to go, Michael falls out, and there you are right there with the chance to win it.
Yeah, it was, you know, the Cosworths definitely had a little bit more power than the Elmores that year, you know. The Buicks always had more power, but they didn't have any reliability to them. And so I was in a Galmer, which was a new car built by my engineer and my designer, Alan Mertens and Rick Gallus. And it truly had a little bit more drag and a little bit more downforce than the current Marches and Lolas at that time. And so, you know, we really didn't have the speed that we needed. You know, we qualified 12th and so I was really praying and hoping for a hot race day. If I could have a hot race day, then that extra downforce and extra drag would not be a penalty. It would be an advantage over, the other cars at that time. Woke up race day morning, and lo and behold, it's the coldest day in the history of the 500.
It was brutally cold.
Oh, mm-hmm. Yeah, and so I just went, well, you know, okay, here's another year. We're going to have to wait till next year to win this thing and that sort of thing. And you know, as the day played out, the actual how cold it was starting to become an advantage, because right away you had the pole sitter on the pace laps, Roberto Guerrero. He crashes on the pace lap because his tires are so cold. Mm-hmm. And we hadn't experienced a day like that all month long. And so you really had to really warm up your tires and pay special attention to that. And because of that, it caught a lot of people out. You know, it caught Mario Andretti out. I mean, a veteran, and it caught a lot of people out, and so there was a lot of attrition that day because of the cold tires and how cold it was. But you know, Michael Andretti had everybody covered. He did a great job all day long, and you know, it was a race for second place that day. There, you know, there was a point in that in the race that year, Michael had second place down the lap, and so I mean he was just gone in a world all by himself. And then there at the end of the race he broke, and Scott Goodyear and I had been battling for second for like the last 50 laps, and we were going back and forth, and we were really equal as far as car performance and car speed. And it all depended on who was in front of who when we came up on traffic, on lap traffic. And I had just gotten by Scott Goodyear because he ran into some lap traffic. It wrecked his momentum, and I was able to get by him. A couple laps later, Michael breaks, and there I am leading the 500. And because there was such little laps left, lap traffic was not going to be an issue. And so we ran the rest of the race just wide open and driving with one eye going forward and the other eye looking at Scott Goodyear, making sure that he wasn't drafting me. So.
Can you talk a little bit more specifically about the final lap in particular and what was going through your head as you went through turn four and then under the checkered flag?
What was actually happening is during the day, because my car had a lot of drag to it, I kept taking rear wing out of it and trying to trim it out and trying to make it faster down the straightaway. On my last stop, I went just a little bit too far. And so as we were running those laps at the end of the race, they're wide open, my car was getting a little bit more loose and more loose, meaning that the rear end had less grip and less grip. And that final lap, I went through turn three and the back end slid up against the wall and I went, oh, you know, I'm too loose. And right when I turned into turn four, the back end stepped out. I had to get out of the throttle just for a second. Oh. And got back in it, and I came off at turn four, and I looked at the run that Scott had on me because he was, you know, he had a fast car and a good handling car. And I went, oh, my God, I've blown another one, you know. And because I thought for sure Scott would be able to pass me down that front straightaway. And had it gone another lap, he would have. You know, it was just, that was for the checkered. And truly, that's what allowed Scott to get up next to me was my handling on my car was going away. And it finally showed on turn four for the checkered.
Well, let's look ahead a couple more years to your win in 1994. That was a very different race for you compared to some of the other ones we've talked about. Can you recall that month of May for us?
Yeah, sure. It was different in the aspect that I was driving for Roger Penske. I was driving for Marlboro, you know, the best team in the business, and it was wonderful. We had developed an engine that no one else had, which was a 209 pushrod engine. It definitely had more power than the competition, and so. You know, that year, it just, everything seemed to fall into place. And it wasn't just the Indy 500, it was the entire season. You know, we had 16 races that year. I won 8 of them. And it just seemed whatever I did, it made the car go faster. Whatever my team did, it always made the car go faster. And just happened at the Indy 500. You know, we sat on the pole because we drew a low number in the qualifying order, and we qualified on Saturday when there was overcast and cool temperatures, and then Sunday came, and Emerson, my teammate, it was hot and windy, and, you know, he was running faster times than I was during the month of May, and he ended up third, and so... everything just seemed to fall our way, you know, and lo and behold, Emerson leads most of that race and then he ends up crashing trying to pass me you know, and put me a lap down, and I was running second. And so when he crashed, it was all us that year. So it was great.
Well, we talked a lot about the highs of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. We're going to have to touch on the lows a little bit here and talk about 1995. We know this is not your favorite topic, but can you talk a little bit about what happened in 95 with not qualifying for the race and the effect that had on you?
It definitely happened, and it's something to talk about because, you know, it was one of those things, you know, like 94, I said, you know, everything we did, it seemed to just work out for us. On the other side of that, in 95, whatever I did made the car go slower. No matter what my team did, it made the car go slower. We didn't do anything right. It was just like kind of almost like we were snake bit. And the whole team was. And so, driving for Roger Penske and Marlboro and, you know, Emerson Fittipaldi, my teammate, you know, we come back to Indy and we can't find any speed at all. And no matter what we did, it just did not work out for us. And there was a time there that my teammate Emerson had a fast enough speed to make the race, and Roger waved it off because he didn't feel it was fast enough. And so there was another time there that I was qualifying, and it was the second attempt on the car that I had, and we were running fast enough to make the race, and on the fourth and final lap, my engine blows up on the back straightaway. Mm. And so no matter what we did, it just didn't work out for us. And so, you know, the greatest team with the greatest record and all that, you know, comes to Indy and defending champion and all of that, and we missed the show. And that was just, I truly felt that, you know, that proved, you know, that there, that speedway, it's hallowed ground. It's God's eyes are on you. And the year before, we definitely snuck an advantage in there. And I think it came around in 95 and, you know, God kind of equaled everything out again. So.
Well, of course, at that time you mentioned you were driving for Roger Penske, the most successful owner by magnitudes of order at Indianapolis. Can you talk to us about what was it like driving for Roger Penske at Indianapolis?
It was wonderful. It was great. I mean, just driving for Roger, you know, I drove for him for 6 years and starting in 94, and just the level of commitment, the level of desire, is fantastic. It's great. You know, I had him on my radio, and he talks to you all during the race, feeding you information, and it's really great to see that commitment and all the people that work for him. They have that same kind of desire and commitment to winning, and it really is a treat to drive for the captain, and so it was great.
Well, after you missed the race in 95, of course, your pain was probably made even worse by the fact the split came later and you had to stay away from Indianapolis for several years. What was it like for the next several years when May came around and you were no longer part of Indianapolis, and then in 2000 when you came back finally for the first time to be a participant again?
I can simply put, there was a hole in my chest, and for those 5 years, and no matter how I tried to fill that hole, it couldn't be done. And you know, I raced all kinds of different cars. I raced all the time to race and be a better race car driver at the Indy 500 my whole life. And during those 5 years when the split was going on, there was just a hole in my chest that could not be filled. And so I finally, in a contract year, you know, I asked Roger, I said, are you coming back to Indy? And he told me no, you know, that he wasn't going to do it. And I said, well, I have to do it. You know, I can't do this anymore, the not missing Indy. And so I got back with my original car owner, Rick Gallus, from Albuquerque, New Mexico, and came back in 2000, and it was great to be back. What can I say? I mean, I love this place, and I always will, and it was just finally that hole in my chest was filled.
Well, Al, you now do driver coaching at Indianapolis, particularly the rookie orientation program. So what is it that you tell rookies about the Speedway when they're coming into it for the first time?
One of the main things I tell them is, you know, when you're going to go through a roller coaster of emotions during the week of practice and the week leading up to the race, try not to have too many highs and too many lows. Try to realize that, you know, each day is a different day, and to be calm and just take it day by day and so on. And that's one of the main things I tell them. And then it all depends on what the question is, you know, that they have. They could have a question about, you know, their line or the groove or what to expect with different temperatures, you know, just all around questions, and that's what I'm there for, and that's what the IndyCar series has me there for, is to try to give that experience to pass it on to the drivers that their teammate wouldn't have, or that their, you know, that their competitors won't tell them because they don't want them to beat them. And so me not being a competitor, they can truly look at me and trust in what I'm telling them. And so I think it helps them out a great deal. So,
mm-hmm. Well, Al, it's been almost 30 years now since you first came to the Speedway as a rookie. How would you say overall the Speedway and the event itself has evolved or changed over those years?
It's changed in a number of ways. Wow. You know, foremost, the Indy 500 has always been the leader in safety technology, you know, with their fire trucks, with their, when there's an accident, how quick they get to the scene, what equipment they have on their trucks. You know, the Indy 500 is where the seatbelt was invented. It's all been about safety, and you know, with my years, they introduced the safer barrier, which is now used at most every racetrack in the country, and so they continue to lead in that area, and I think will for forever. You've had the Formula One race that they brought in there and put a road course racetrack in the infield of it. I've seen a new golf course built over the years. You know, there's just so much that the new pagodas, you know, the new suites. I mean, it's evolved in all in a positive way, and it'll continue in the future, in the next 100 years, to lead in all areas of racing. And so, you know, it's the oldest race in the world, has the most tradition, has the most innovation to it, and I'm very proud to be a part of that.
Well, with 19 starts, this next question is asking a lot of you, but we'll give it a shot. From all of your experience at Indianapolis, are you able to pick one favorite memory out of all of those? And on the flip side of that, we probably know what your greatest disappointment is, but let's ask you anyway.
Yeah, my, you know, I have a lot of great memories about Indy, and you know, of course, winning it the first time is the memory that really, you know, because of my family's success and you know, because of what happened to us in '89, you know, being so close to winning it and it slipping away from us. You know, 92 is, you know, my first year that I won. That's when I got to drink the milk for the first time. You know, that really stands out. You know, a dream come true is pulling out in rookie orientation in 1983, you know, onto the racetrack in a race car myself. You know, that was a dream come true in itself also. You know, those are great moments, you know. You know, the one that you know, the greatest disappointment was missing it in 1995. That was for sure just crushing to myself, to my family, to my team, everyone. So it was, that was the greatest disappointment, you know.
Well, Al, in the grand scheme of things, if you can put it all in summary here, what does it mean to you today to be a champion of the Indianapolis 500?
It's very gratifying. You know, it's something that, it's a dream come true. It's, you know, I dreamed about just racing in the Indy 500 and that dream came true. And then, to go and win it is another dream that came true. And then, you know, to, go out and drive for Roger and win it for Roger, you know, another dream come true. And so, you know, winning the Indy 500, it's really difficult for me to put into words what it actually means to me, but, you know, with my family and all that kind of stuff, it's very gratifying. It's a goal that has been accomplished. You know, a lot of just sacrifice, a lot of desire, everything that it takes to become a winner or a champion in whatever business or sport you're in. When that comes true and when you accomplish those goals, there's a feeling inside you like I'm sure, you know, all of us feel, and it's hard to describe what that truly means. And so, you know, it means a bundle of words, and that's what it means to me to win at Indy.
Well, Al, your statement to Jack Arute in 1992, you just don't know what Indy means, has really inspired so many people when it comes to the Indianapolis 500, including us, as it's the theme of our centennial interview series and our coverage of the month of May this month. So your just overt love for the Indianapolis Motor Speedway and your very open and candid responses here have been a real joy for us to listen to. Thank you so much for being so open with us and sharing your memories.
You betcha. Well, thank you for having us on. And anytime talking about the Indy 500, I get a spring in my step, and I love talking about it. So even the bad times, you know, I mean, you know, what would the good times be without the bad times? So, you know, I love the Speedway, and I hope to come back for many, many years to come. So
that's awesome. Thank you so much for joining us, Al. We really appreciate your time this morning.
You betcha. Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening as well. And please continue to stay with us throughout the month of May as we speak to every 500 winner that we can reach as part of our centennial interview series. And remember that morefrontwing.com is your source online for blogs, photos, podcasts, and more covering the Eyes Odd IndyCar series and beyond.